Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Womanjika, welcome and come with purpose to the Two Bays podcast. My name's Matt Sykes, and along with Claire Wild, we're super excited to be taking another step in this series, a collaboration with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council, specifically focused on climate action champions in different parts of the peninsula. Today, we're joined by Simone Watts, executive chef and farmer at Barragunda, and Sophie O'Neill, founder and owner at Torello Farm. So just before we begin, we will do a shout out and acknowledgement of country, those beautiful bays, Nerm, Port Phillip and Wurrumbirrin or Murrumbik, Western Port, and those cultural connections to country through elders past and present, and specifically the Boomerang and Bunurong communities that are connected to those places. Also other First Peoples that are living in different parts of the peninsula and maintain their own cultural connections as well. I guess what we're talking about, you know, today in linking in different kinds, food and tourism, there is that sense that caring for and being connected to the land is something that I guess we all take on that custodianship role, but really honouring that legacy of place and that connection to country that we're all part of. Alrighty, Simone, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. I guess what we'll kick off with is hearing your take on climate change and what it looks like on the Mornington Peninsula, and I guess why climate action is so important also on the peninsula. Over to you.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me, Claire and Matt. It's a pleasure and privilege to be here. Look, climate change on the peninsula is, like anywhere in the world at the moment, incredibly prevalent and very important that we're acting on it. The peninsula specifically has been deforested and grazed historically for a very long time. And I think the emphasis now on getting trees back in the ground and diversifying the agriculture that's happening here is a way that we can really start working on it. Look, the Mornington Peninsula has only about 30% of its original vegetation left, and over half of that is on private land. So our ability as individual custodians to make some real change is very, you know, you actually feel like it's tangible, as opposed to, you know, sometimes climate change feels like it's too hard to be a part of. But sort of furthermore to that, the style of agriculture that's happening on the areas that have been previously grazed, the importance of diversifying that. I think close to 50% of the agriculture that happens on the peninsula at the moment is livestock. So you're talking a lot of cows, you're talking a lot of grazing. And then you've got things like equine horses, which, if you don't really get me started on the lack of purpose of horses in agriculture, that'd be a completely different podcast. But you've got about the same amount of area that's devoted to horses as you do wine, which is pretty crazy when you think most people would consider the peninsula as a wine growing region, which, you know, the potential there for better practice and for tangibility to market is much better, I guess, than horses roaming around doing not much at all. But then if you look at market gardens, so an area that you've got much more potential to have a huge amount of diversity, the amount of land devoted to that is only half that of horses and wines. So I think, you know, really looking at what we're doing with our land on the peninsula is a great way to start with climate change.
Thanks, Simone. So from Barragunda down at Cape Schenck across to a Torello farm just outside of Dramana there. Torello farm, you know, Sophie, it's one of those spots that I'm sure for many people is a go-to, you know, in their local weekly shop, or if they're visiting the peninsula, they drop in, and you've always got such beautiful food there, and really it is beautiful, but you've got the backdrop of all of that productivity, you know, that you're talking about, Simone. So yeah, what's your take on why climate action is so important on the peninsula and of course its connection to food?
Yeah, I'm very much going to pick up on what Simone's talking about as far as, you know, how we're using the land on the peninsula. And you know, we're an incredible food bowl, very close to Melbourne, which makes a lot of sense from an environmental point of view. Yet there is so much land that's not being used to grow food. And yeah, I echo your thoughts on the equine industry, which will possibly be controversial, but we need to grow more food on the land, on the peninsula. And obviously a real barrier for that is the cost of land. So, you know, Simone and I have been very active in working with the Mornington Peninsula Shire in trying to set up a program to incubate young farmers to see more land being used on the peninsula to grow organic food with a regenerative agricultural focus.
Sophie and Simone, that was so great to hear your reflections on how those really tangible things that you're doing on the peninsula can be used to really support climate action. I think often when we talk about the climate crisis and we talk about things we can do about it, in particular the way that we can support nature restoration and biodiversity and all those sorts of things, it can feel really disconnected from our day-to-day work and the day-to-day things that we do as individuals. So it's so nice to hear a little bit more about how the two of you are firstly influencing that in a positive way through your own work, and secondly, the opportunity that we have for others as well to do that at a broader scale. Reflecting on the contribution that you're both making to climate action, I'd love to hear from you a little bit more about the specifics of the work that you're doing. So maybe, Sophie, I'll hand to you first to tell us just a little bit more about your work and how it came to be and sort of how you got to where you are today.
Thanks, Claire. I've had a background in food most of my working life, but my husband and I and his family purchased Torello, the land, in 2016 and recognised an opportunity to sell local produce to the local community. My background had been farmers markets. So, you know, we've now probably got about 70 different local farms that supply the farm gate. And we also grow food we grow produce on the land at Torello, the farming incubator program being one of the people who grow on the land there. And then we also grow beef and lamb on our property in Toorong. I think that what I love about what we do and the difference that I feel like we're making is that we are providing an outlet for small-scale farmers to get a genuine return for the produce that they grow, and that's and by doing that, that actually encourages other people to grow food on the peninsula. You know, the duopoly and the kind of situation that we have with supermarkets in this country means that often only big farmers can survive, and then that comes with a whole lot of problems and challenges and from an environmental stance. So having a small little outlet like Torello that provides an opportunity for small farmers, it's actually what thrills me and in every sense.
Oh, that's so great to hear, Sophie. And I think as well, what you spoke about sounds like it's really influencing positive change elsewhere, particularly in terms of that small scale farming and sort of showing what's possible and encouraging people to learn from what you're doing and take that elsewhere. Simone, I'd love to hear from you on that. In particular, how Barragunda came to be, how you ended up being involved in all of that work.
So Barragunda is a large working farm on the back beaches of the peninsula. The Morris family has owned it for some time now and put in a lot of incredible infrastructure here and had some very beautiful visions of it being an organic farm that was quite diverse. Probably, you know, the time when they began that, the ability to the distribution models weren't quite as connected as they are now, and some aspects of the farm sort of went to sleep for a while, and they were largely grazing cattle on the property. And then it was about 4 years ago now that I moved home to the Mornington Peninsula from far north Queensland, and Hayley Morris, who's one of the owners and good friend of mine and sort of my boss, she sort of had always said, come to the farm. And when I visited and saw the scale and the scope for a really incredible, diverse place where I could create a farm-to-table restaurant, my sort of dreams and brain went a little bit wild. But that was 4 years ago, and looking back on it now, it was probably a fairly selfish notion of, wow, I just get to open my dream restaurant. And after that time, sort of COVID happened, and we had to take a step back, and the progress for the build took a back seat. And I was really sort of forced to stop and ask what was going to be really important on the farm. And it wasn't just to open a restaurant. We sort of had to ask ourselves what is best for the environment, what is best for our community, which at that point in time was access to food systems. And also what was going to work for young farmers, because access to land and capital down here is really tricky. You know, you can't, an acre of land for $1 million selling carrots is not going to be a very good business model. So that kind of got us thinking. And from there, the Barragunda Collective was born. So the collective is a hub of young farmers who lease land off us, so they have the potential to run their own business. We have really affordable leases, and then they then have access to large-scale machinery, to irrigation, to things that would be quite difficult to set up as a new young farmer. But then we also have a distribution model connected to them. So eventually, once the restaurant's built, they will sell to us, rather than that sort of kitchen garden model that a lot of other people have, where they pay a farmer. The farmer has the ability to still run their own business on site, but, you know, transport the food 10, 15 metres into the restaurant. But then they also have the ability to sell to other local businesses like Torello. And we also offer an online platform where they can sell through our collective model as well. So it was all about, as Sophie was saying, sort of connecting farmers directly to the public and trying to get as much money into their pockets as possible, and creating a diverse system and a support network as well. You know, it's very hard as a young farmer starting out to do it on your own, but, you know, we're all down there at the potting shed having a beer on a Friday talking about whether the week's been really good or whether the week's been really crappy. And so, yeah, I think once the restaurant's open, it'll be a really nice little holistic family that is in our own way combating climate change. But I guess for me, I'm probably of the notion that, you know, greenwashing and trying to reinvent the wheel with a million and one new ideas of how we're going to fix climate change isn't really the answer. That the answer is slowing down, reconnecting, reducing our footprint, and working together on a community grassroots level.
Thanks so much, Simone and Sophie. Brilliant to understand that context, and really curious to dive a little bit deeper here. And you talked about the potting shed there and that Friday drink, Sophie. Simone. I'm curious about, you know, what are the things that you talk about, and does climate ever come up in the conversation when you're having a yarn over a beer with the rest of the team, and you're thinking about, you know, you talked about it being this holistic vision. But at the same time, I know that particularly around young people, and both of you are talking about the importance of the next generation of farmers having access to these opportunities. And climate anxiety or eco-anxiety can be one of those challenges, but it also can be a really powerful motivator because it, you know, getting into action, starting a business, getting into the land is one of those things that actually makes you feel like you're transforming that anxiety into action. But yeah, take us to the potting shed. What are the conversations that are happening on a typical Friday?
I probably won't go into the conversations that happen after work on the Friday, but I can go into some other conversations that we have. Look, I think, you know, as a team, we have holistic decision making pillars that we work towards, so that every week we're checking back in on those to make sure that we're, although we're individual businesses, we're all aligned with the same goals. And so those discussions do come up around how we can always be doing things better. I guess one of the projects that probably stands out for me on the farm that is something that we're all kind of working on, whether it be in the market garden or in the grazing area, is our revegetation work. So my partner, Sam, runs a native nursery called Reforest. He's also sort of part of the collective, runs his own nursery, but he grows all of the trees for the revegetation work that we do on the property. So some of that happens in the orchard rows for windbreaks. Some of that happens down in the grazing area to help reduce some of the erosion from being overgrazed for many, many years. But then in the market garden as well, we have hedgerows around there to sort of help create, you know, biodiversity for our farmers. But sort of one of the key things and differences, I guess, for our nursery to other Indigenous nurseries is that Sam collects the vast majority of seed and cuttings from the land itself. So you have that strength and resilience in the plants that they're actually grown here. They're endemic to these sandy soils. And that way, when we're putting them in, the chance of their survival is a lot higher. And he's here on site maintaining them as well, because that's one of the huge things that's just never spoken about in big, I won't name names of particular planting people, that different projects, it just not looked after. It's one thing to put trees in the ground. It's another to come back every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, and make sure that they're still there. You know, we've had planting revegetation projects here on the property before that have only had a 1 or 2% survival rate with some of these other organizations. And I think that's, you know, where the world of carbon credits can and greenwashing can just be completely lost, because, you know, if you're not actually creating habitat, you know, you can't just be putting big plantations in. You need to be creating understories, grasses, trees. And, you know, Sam, credit to him, is amazing in that. We're very lucky to have him, but it is something that a project that we all talk about quite frequently and that we're all involved in.
Yeah, it's exciting that you've brought Sam's story and services and skills into the conversation, because seed banks is something that and that local provenance, you know, and that always the power of the grassroots of things that we see, not just in this, you know, podcast series, but in a lot of other work that we do. And I think that alternative that you painted of some of the increase in, let's say, investment in nature and biodiversity and climate and these things, some of it does risk being misdirected and ineffective. And it's one of the, you know, I think it's like target 3 of the global biodiversity framework focuses on this effective management of, or the goal is that 30% of the planet's lands and waters are in protected and conserved areas by 2030. But the key premise there being the effective management, and that comes down to the people at the front line, like what you're describing. So thanks for taking us straight there. Sophie, I guess just to change tack for a moment, you talked about that background that you had in farmers markets, and what's kind of cool about this conversation is we're really talking about the whole food system and our different relationships with food. But I'm curious for you as an individual with your, you know, your husband, when you were shifting from that experience and that skill set of farmers markets to like, all right, let's do our own thing. Let's set up a farm gate. Let's incubate local farmers. Let's, you know, produce on a couple of properties. How did that like personally feel for you to kind of embark on that new chapter of discovery? And who did you look to for support and help? Were they already people you knew, or did you have to open up completely new networks?
It's a really good question. I think it's just evolved. I mean, I think one of the sort of things that I really enjoy doing in my work is connecting with people and, you know, kind of following a trail. And, you know, I have been known to remember a pomegranate person at a farmer's market and went, wait a minute, they're on the peninsula, and then gone down a rabbit hole and gone, hey, well, that's right. And then been the crazy lady driving down a road in Balnarring, a dirt road in Balnarring, looking for the pomegranate orchard. Yeah, so I think my curiosity has always helped me connect with people. And I am also from a farming family, so just understanding farmers and being sympathetic and to their kind of skill sets and needs and stuff like that has helped as well. And I just really enjoy it. It's thrilling. It is absolutely thrilling when you find a new producer of something. It's like a shot in the arm for me. And, you know, and that seems what's really is exciting is that the longer Torello kind of goes on, the more that seems to be happening. There's lots, the peninsula is this sort of patchwork of small farms doing really, really cool things, despite the crazy prices of land. And I think, you know, like I've kind of kept tapping back to because I'm so passionate about it, but if we can kind of find more landholders willing to have people growing food on their land, even if it's not them, that patchwork will just continue and it'll become even more diverse, which will be good for everyone.
And that image that you paint of the future as well, it's no doubt influenced by your own, you know, childhood growing up and being around farming. Is there a memory that you've got with grandparents or parents or uncles and aunties where, it's just a fond memory or something that has stayed with you that, when you reflect back has actually been part of informing where you are now?
Look, I think it was just a childhood that was very free and you know, kind of lots of exploring and probably at the time I didn't really appreciate the kind of deep understanding of food that was cemented in. It was just a really beautiful free childhood. And now I'm quite grateful that my kids have sort of, you know, are growing up on the land as well, and things that I sort of take for granted, that they take for granted. I sometimes worry when they, you know, go to uni and live in the city that they're going to eat really crap food and go, oh, this is crap. Like, what? But yeah, just, you know, growing your own food and appreciating where things come from is something that's second nature to them. And I suppose in a sense that was similar to me. I mean, we didn't have quite, you know, I grew up in Forbes in central west New South Wales, so it wasn't, you know, I remember an avocado being very exotic. But still, you know, we had access to a lot of beautiful produce, and I think having that in your life just cements a really an appreciation for good food.
Yeah, those values are something that really, yeah, it seems to be critical here, and it's beautiful that you're able to pass that on across generations. Simone, coming back to your story where, you know, you had this relationship with someone and they were saying, you know, come and work, you know, on our land and work with us on this vision. What was that dynamic like of having someone that, you know, could kind of help give you an opportunity as a young person coming up and allow you to get a start, but because of that, just that closeness, that connection that you've got? Can you tell us a bit more?
Look, I have a really beautiful relationship with Hayley, and I think it actually started when we were up. So I was the executive chef at the Daintree Eco Lodge, which the Morris family owned at the time, and Hayley came up for a visit one time and we sort of met and got talking, and I think it was sort of one of those aha moments of like, oh, you get it. We can talk about this, and, you know, maybe we can be in this fight together. And then sort of when I came back here and she said to come and look at the farm, I think after that it was kind of probably me floating a lot of ideas to her. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm a bit of a nuisance. I have one of those busy minds that I feel like every other day I'm emailing her and I was like, what do you think about this? Maybe we could do this. But I'm very lucky that I have someone there that has, you know, a property like this that trusts me and our team to be making decisions on a day-to-day basis that are going to create a space where, you know, her kids are always going to feel safe and that she's giving back to the community. It's a really nice relationship.
Oh, brilliant. And that, you know, that trust is just such an incredible gift, you know, because it's, yeah, if people perhaps that, you know, haven't had that support or that relationship and that encounter for you, maybe it might be a bit trickier for them to step in. But I think, you know, it's an incredible example. And yeah, who would have thought that the Daintree would be such a powerful connector in that way?
It's crazy.
I used to work down in Tasmania, guiding walks along the Bay of Fires and also managing the overland track, the Cradle Mountain Huts walk. And food was just so integral to those experiences. And I think, again, that's something that, you know, we're able to appreciate on a place like the Mornington Peninsula and be, yeah, very, very fortunate, not just for visitors, but importantly for locals. I'm curious, and I know that we've, you know, this podcast series, it is about climate action and trying to encourage people to start their own journeys in this space. And one of the things that perhaps comes up as a bit of a challenge in people's mind is they're like, oh, if I start thinking about or I do a climate project or I start embedding that into our business models, that mean that other parts of it are going to fall behind and, you know, I'm not going to be able to keep up and manage both at the same time. But I suspect for both of you, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand. Is there an example of something that you do day to day or just, you know, season to season where you're like, hey, we know this is going to be good for climate, but it's also good for business as well. Sophie, I'll come to you to that one first.
Yeah, look, I think the thing that comes to mind when you ask that question, Matt, is packaging. and, you know, Simone touches about greenwashing, and I think packaging, they're the masters of it. And we are not doing it completely right at Torello. When we first opened the business, our kids were at Balnarring Primary and they were, it's a very environmental little school, and they were like, you can't have plastic bags. And we went, oh, but what about those biodegradable ones? I mean, this is like, you know, kind of in 2017. And they went, no, they break up and they end up in the oceans and cause all sorts of problems. So we didn't do plastic bags, and that, and at the time I was like, oh, this is risky, but here we go. And it was amazing. People just so, you know, it was, you've got to remember this was a little while ago before the supermarkets or anyone were on board with it. But I still am so, I'm so conflicted by packaging and the challenges of it. So we process whole animals of beef and lamb each week. And at the moment we're not using compostable Cryovac bags, but you know, that's something I want to transition into. But then when I go down the rabbit hole of that, I kind of have to commit to a huge, you know, quite large number of compostable Cryovac bags to make it worthwhile, because they're quite expensive, and then you've got a 12-month, so they, all those sort of, you know, decisions are constantly playing around in your head, and you know what's right, but you also have to, you know, you have the realities of business. And then, you know, just yesterday I was sitting down with one of my staff members who is actually studying all of this at uni, and I'm like, tell me which one to use. Like, should I be using this tray or this tray? And yeah, I think we're trying to do the right thing. I absolutely know that we're not 100% perfect and we've got a long way to go. And then there's also, you know, the need for, I'm often accused of putting the boot into supermarkets, but if supermarkets were a bit more on board with this sort of thing, then it would flow down to everybody. So, yeah.
So there is that dynamic of the scaling of these things, as well as this element of progress over perfection too, because it is a constant, you know, like any other part of a business, I guess you're constantly looking at that. Simone, is it packaging for you? Is there another part of it that it talks about that relationship between the, you know, the well-being of the business, well-being of climate, and those being able to align, or sometimes how that can be challenging?
Yeah, look, it's It's a tricky question to broach, and like I often feel a little bit strange about answering things that are in relation to business and farming, or I don't really believe climate change should be looked at from an investment frame of mind. By expecting some kind of return when we're working as one with nature, this continues the concept of us managing Mother Nature and being above her rather than part of her. And so I think, you know, when we use that word investment, it's always like I want something back. And I think that's one of the big shifts in mindset with regenerative agriculture, is that you're doing it to repair things that have happened for a long time. You're not waking up in the morning and going, well, I expect my bank balance to look better. That being said, there is a lot of different practices within regenerative agriculture that do assist in saving money. For us, it probably like the no-till side of things, we try to do as little tilling as possible in the market garden. Because of that, you're using less tractors, so you're using less diesel, you're reducing your fossil fuels, you're keeping more carbon in the soil, it's less labor. So there's those side of things. And then I guess in the grazing as well, because we're doing rotational grazing, we've seen a lot more health in our pasture, which means that we can sell more lucerne and hay. We don't have to buy hay in. And the animals are healthier as well. The animals are bigger. Therefore, if they go to market, they've got more weight. So there's small things like that. But I still think that, yeah, changing that shift in mindset, and, you know, that goes back to the, you know, obviously pretty against carbon credits and that side of things. So, yeah, that just always expecting some sort of return when giving back to nature, it's not the right frame of mind, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you raised something really powerful there in this, probably there's an economic systems change going on globally and locally, and there is this dynamic where it's all been about profit, and then this purpose beyond profit movement, which has coming into play and rising up in different forms. But then kind of reading between the lines in what you're saying, like this ecological mindset isn't a strange thing. It's probably got deeper roots than this, you know, short-term, capitalist in the tradition, in the purest form. But I guess we're trying to remember this stuff in some ways. Like we're trying to just remember that connection to nature. So I think there's something really down to earth and really fundamental in what you're sharing. Unfortunately, Claire's having technical difficulties in this episode, so I'm carrying the baton here. Sophie, I'm going to pass it across to you. If you imagine yourself walking along your favorite beach on the peninsula, and there are absolutely an abundance of them, and you reflected back to when you were first starting out in this particular chapter of your career, is there any advice that you'd be able to pass on to someone perhaps navigating a career transition and thinking about that next step with a climate or an environmental aspect embedded as that? What's a little pearl of wisdom that you'd share to your former self?
Look, I think that, I'm always coming to things from a food perspective. That's my background. And I think what I would tell myself back then is that there is an appetite for people to want to, particularly, and this definitely, I mean, I would tell myself that COVID was coming too, and that would have been helpful. I saw during COVID a massive shift in consumers about where they got their food from, about a desperate want to connect to local growers and local food systems, and then as a result of that, I've seen more people wanting to grow local food. And so I would say, yeah, so just believe in, so really have faith in that there are people who want to make a change. And when we talk about climate change and some of us feel paralyzed on, you know, what we can and can't do, really just look at how you're spending your food dollars or anything really. But you know, look at, am I buying, you know, from a local producer? What are the food miles on it? How has it been produced? And really think about that, because that's the smallest change that you can make. And it's so effective.
I would tell myself to be patient. And Mother Nature works very slowly, as do building permits. And change doesn't happen overnight. And also just not to get too caught up in the textbooks, I think. Connecting to the land you're on and understanding its nuances can't always be taught by a set of principles and techniques. It's important to get out and put your feet in the soil where you stand and see how things are working, and not just sort of expect to read this set amount of rules of the way that you should farm, because it disconnects you.
Thank you so much, Sophie and Simone, for taking us on this journey and sharing your experiences. And I think, again, something that we're hearing more and more in each of these episodes is that climate action doesn't fit in a box, and there's personal stories like yours and journeys and decision-making and whole mindsets, I suppose, that are fundamental to just the way that you're going about things. And yes, that might align in certain strategic plans with a climate this or a climate that, but it's actually about a way of life and about a way of being in the world. So Simone, your story of Barragunda, the way it's evolving, the restaurant that's coming up, Sophie, what you're doing at Torello Farm and making food accessible, and this intergenerational dynamic that we have to acknowledge as well. It's super inspiring. So thank you so much for joining us on the Two Bays podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure. So until next time, this has been the Two Bays podcast with Matt and Claire. We'll see you next time. Cheers. How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out for new episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in, and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.